It's Pro Savings Days at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances and save an additional $1,000 when you buy four select LG major appliances. Plus, get a free DeWalt 20-volt max 5-amp-hour battery when you buy a select DeWalt 20-volt max tool. Get the job done for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/26. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for more details and qualifying items.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am the culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Sean O'Connell. Thanks for being back on the show, Sean.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So today we're talking about Bruce Willis. Specifically, we're talking about your new book, Bruce Willis, Celebrating the Cinematic Legacy of an Unbreakable Hollywood Icon. We all know and love Bruce Willis here, and we were all sad to see him retire, of course, but there's much to celebrate. So let's get right into it and ask the most basic question first. What was it that made you want to sit down and spend hours upon hours, not just writing this book, because I mean, it's writing is a, but watching all of the Bruce Willis movies, and I do mean all of them, looking at the capsule reviews at the end of this, all except one, interestingly, looking at the capsule reviews at the end of this book. So what was it that made you want to sit down and get into Bruce Willis's filmography?
So without question, it was his retirement, the announcement of his retirement due to the diagnosis of aphasia. And I really was struck at how that moved me, how profound I thought the lack of the fact that Bruce Willis is going to be making any more movies impacted me. I'm a huge fan of his. I have been forever. I've always kind of admired his ability to switch genres. But it wasn't until I actually sat down and started looking over his filmography and really starting to think about it that I started to realize how often he zigged when other people were zagging, or, you know, took risks and went after filmmakers he thought had strong vision and a strong voice to kind of support them at early stages in his career or in their career. And so while he often gets lumped in, I think, with just the action genre, which obviously is the biggest one for him, you know, there are so many other films that we think of and that people tend to forget that he took a chance on and went out on a limb for, and sometimes failed spectacularly, but sometimes led to some of his most successful films, things like The Sixth Sense, you know, or 12 Monkeys or something like that. So what I wanted to do was divide his career up into different sections and sort of analyze, you know, what was happening during those points of his career, what was happening in the film industry at some of those points in his career. What I don't get into, and what some people might be looking for in the book, is a lot of the off-screen gossipy type stuff. I mean, when it comes to Bruce, he was obviously one of the biggest stars on the planet, and his relationship with Demi Moore was tabloid fodder for decades kind of thing. I really just wanted to zero in on the work he did in Hollywood, on the films that he put out, and try to chart, you know, this course of what I think is, you know, an irregular Hollywood A-lister and the last of a dying breed. Like, we just don't see actors like him anymore. We don't see stars with that type of drawing power who are using it then to get, you know, filmmakers like Quentin Tarantino, Ryan Johnson, you know, to get them their shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to look at his career, which, you know, it kind of, we could pinpoint Moonlighting, I think, is a fair place to start. You know, he had been in, he had some bit extra type stuff earlier, but Moonlighting was the thing that really got him going. And it's funny, I don't know if you've watched Moonlight at all recently. It's back on Hulu for the first time in years. I had Glenn Gordon Caron, the creator of the show, on this show to talk about it a few months back, which was a real joy. But it is fascinating to watch that show because Bruce Willis really does appear on the screen fully formed as the idea of Bruce Willis, the thing that we think of when we think of Bruce Willis. He is there kind of in his entirety at the start of that show. And that does, and that carries over really into, certainly into Die Hard, but into the rest of his work as well, right?
It does. And I really think that that's just who he was, especially in those early stages. There was a story I found from John Goodman that I included in the book, which is that Goodman knew Willis back when he was tending bar in New York, before Moonlighting. And apparently Bruce was like the show, you know, people went to his bar essentially, and it's the bar that Cocktail ended up being inspired by. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and Bruce was just a showman, an entertainer. So when he landed in Hollywood, I don't think he changed much. I think he just brought that persona. And that carries over into at least John McClane, you know, for Die Hard. And the thing that I think breaks that persona is probably Hudson Hawk. Like, Hudson Hawk to me is the most unfiltered Bruce Willis movie. You know, it's Looney Tunes madcap comedy. It's him singing songs. It's a bit of action sprinkled through. But when that gets rejected by the audience, you know, so fully, he's like, oh, people don't really want that much of me. I better go back to traditional action. And that's when you get like Striking Distance and Last Boy Scout and movies like that. But then he evolves into this more stoic, minimalistic, quiet leading man, you know, and relies on just his rugged presence to start carrying him. And then that's a whole nother phase of his career.
Well, it's interesting, too, because he, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about Willis compared to Schwarzenegger or Stallone, who,
sure,
you know, he's most regularly lumped in with. And both of those guys made a conscious decision at a certain point in their career that they had to be funny, that it wasn't enough to just do the action stuff. They also had to be funny. That broadens their appeal. It broadens their audience. But also it's like the evolution of the action hero. And Willis is almost the opposite of that. Willis starts with that humor baked into his action roles. And then kind of as he progresses, as we get up to, you know, even movies like The Sixth Sense or Unbreakable, Last Man Standing, I guess, a few years before that, he definitely starts to retreat some into a less comedic shell.
Sure. Yeah, without a doubt. And even with the Die Hard franchise, if you just use that as an example, like look how bitter and disgruntled John McClane became starting with A Vengeance. You know, mm-hmm. like it's a conscious choice to make him hungover, you know, and estranged from his family. And that became a talking point in each of those films moving forward, because I think he wanted to get away from the jokey element of John McClane and establish it as more of like a gritty sort of harder edged take. And I don't know what that was, because maybe he just didn't want to be pigeonholed as the comedic, sarcastic, you know, anti-hero. Maybe he felt he'd done that before, but he wasn't afraid to go, you know, like when he does the whole nine yards with Matthew Perry, he still does the intimidating gangster, you know, he's still the alpha male in the piece, but isn't afraid to go after laughs. And then, and also in something like that, what I think the whole nine yards kind of singles out is that Bruce was always happy to be part of an ensemble and wasn't afraid to be the A-list leading man who was setting up other people for the joke. And I found that to be pretty admirable and separated him from those guys like Stallone and Schwarzenegger also.
Yeah, he does. He definitely does the ensemble thing pretty well. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly in Pulp Fiction, of course, where he's not even, I think he's not technically the leading man. I don't know who would be, who is the leading, is John Travolta the leading man technically?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think they probably all have equal parts, you know, equal screen time. But Bruce is the fourth person anybody thinks of when they talk about Pulp Fiction. You know, it's instantly, it's Travolta, Sam Jackson, and then, who's
Uma Thurman.
Sorry. Yeah, Uma Thurman. Thank you. And then of course they all get Oscar nominations and he gets left out. The thing that kills me about The Sixth Sense is everyone in The Sixth Sense gets Oscar nominated and Bruce doesn't even get a sniff. And throughout the course of all of this research, I could never figure out why the Academy just refused to take him seriously and even give him a nomination. Like eventually I'm assuming now because of this diagnosis, he's going to get an honorary Oscar at some point. And it's going to feel cheap because I think that he deserves it for several other performances. 12 Monkeys to me is his best performance ever. And then Pitt gets nominated for Chewing the Scenery.
Yeah. I want to talk about 12 Monkeys and The Fifth Element, because those are two. The thing that has always jumped out at me about his career is Bruce Willis is at the height of his powers. He's commanding $15, $20 million a movie. He's putting up enormous box office numbers and Die Hard with a Vengeance and Armageddon and other stuff. And kind of sandwiched in between these movies, he makes 12 Monkeys, which is a sci-fi thriller, but very strange. Terry Gilliam movie, very strange, very unusual. Remake of a black and white French short, you know, like not the sort of thing you would expect necessarily from Bruce Willis. And he also makes The Fifth Element. Now, The Fifth Element is I think in hindsight, we look at it and it's more like, okay, this is an action comedy. It's big.
Sure.
It's we look at that, we're like, okay, but you know, at the time, it's a strange movie. It's a big space opera with a literal opera in it at one point.
Yeah.
And he makes these movies. He makes these movies for less money. He makes these movies with directors. Well, Terry Gilliam had been around for a while. Lots of people knew him. Luc Besson had been around for a while. Had some successes, but like nobody was like, we're going to give Besson, you know, $80 million or whatever this cost to make a movie until Bruce Willis signs on. It takes a little bit less to do it. Yep. And that is the heart of his career, is doing that sort of thing.
100%. And I think a lot of that stems from him having such early success, you know, that he doesn't have to make decisions for financial reasons necessarily. And that's a little bit why, and if you want to talk about this later, we can. I don't understand the last 3 years of his career, you know, these direct-to-DVD videos that he took or gigs that he took, because I don't think Bruce Willis ever needed a paycheck gig kind of thing. And what else could those roles be beyond, you know, just taking something quick for the money? But anyway, back to those other choices. I listened to a lot of interviews. I read a lot of interviews with Bruce over the years. Ever since Bonfire of the Vanities, right around that time, and also because of the amount of press that he and Demi Moore generated, he has a real distrust for the press and a real distrust for the process of talking to press on behalf of a movie. So this could just be canned answers. I'm not quite sure. But he reiterated some version of, for Fifth Element, for 12 Monkeys, for so many of his movies, they really were driven by the fact that it was a director that he wanted to work with, you know, or did it seemed like he was going to have fun on the project because he didn't have to make the movie, you know, for any sort of financial reason, or he wasn't thinking long term about his career. It was just in the moment. Am I going to have a good time doing this? Is this somebody that I want to work for? On the flip side of that, people like Besson and Gilliam needed Bruce gave you an opening weekend, you know, at the very least. Putting his name above the title meant you were going to get an audience to come. And then from what I heard, you know, through different interviews with people like Ryan Johnson, with Tarantino, with M. Night Shyamalan, is that Bruce would at least run studio interference and say, no, I like this script. I like this kid's story. You know, we're doing it this way. Whether it's Luc Besson coloring in big, vibrant colors, you know, to make a space opera, as you say, or Gilliam going as weird as he does, you know, with 12 Monkeys, there was some safety net because, oh, we've got Bruce, at least it's going to open. And I think more than anybody else, he used that clout to get interesting movies made. Looper being a great example. Like Ryan Johnson says, like, I couldn't have gotten Looper made if Bruce didn't step in and say, I'm doing this. He goes, I'm coming off of The Brothers Bloom. You know, yeah, I have Joseph Gordon-Levitt to work with. I've got a few other pieces of players who want to play with me. But the minute that Bruce Willis says he wants to do it, I'm in another realm completely, and yeah, I can do what I want to do. And I think Bruce did that so often over the course of his career that I have to believe it's deliberate.
Yeah, and he does have a track record of working with good, interesting directors. And this is something he shares with with Schwarzenegger in particular. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is working with, you know, guys like James Cameron, Walter Hill, Paul Verhoeven, not pushovers, not people he can kind of, you know, bully around on the set, people he can learn from. And I'm not saying that Bruce Willis was like wanted to learn from, but he wanted to work with interesting directors who had a view and a vision.
Yeah, De Palma, you know,
right.
Walter Hill, even on Last Man Standing. Yeah, obviously McTiernan on a couple of different films, Antoine Fuqua, people like that. Yeah, definitely sought them out. Less so, you know, later on in his career. And, you know, but then every once in a while over the course of it, you know, when we go back to why did Bruce do that project, you know, he had a lot of this creative freedom because of, like, you know, he would land on an Armageddon. And then Armageddon would just be a behemoth for him, mm-hmm. you know, and it allowed him to do the next five or six movies that he wanted to do. Or Die Hard with a Vengeance. Die Hard with a Vengeance came along at a time when Bruce was a little bit struggling, you know, felt like, okay, I can go back to the well of the Die Hard franchise. And then that allows him to explore and go do a bunch of other things that he wants to after that point. But there are long stretches where Bruce does things like Mortal Thoughts, you know, or Color of Night, you know, and you're like, what was he doing here? What was this? You know, what inspired this? And who's to say? Maybe it was just a screenplay that caught his eye, or, you know, the chance to go golf someplace. I'm not sure. On some of them.
Fit into a schedule nicely. I mean,
yeah, sure.
I mean, look, again, you look at his output. I think he made, what, four films in 1994?
I mean, there was a time where he was averaging 3 to 4 movies a year.
Yeah.
Without question. And again, movie stars don't do that right now. There's no one else who's putting out that type of stuff.
Yeah. And even then, really, I mean, that's not a common pace for him. And that plays into the whole, you know, kind of blue collar idea of Bruce Willis, working guy, working stiff. I'm out there. It's a very British actor sensibility. It's the sort of thing that you see like a Michael Caine do or something like that.
But the other thing I like about Bruce a ton that I think Schwarzenegger does really well, but Stallone never did, was he's not afraid to lampoon himself. Mm-hmm. And he was doing it early on, you know, to get a chance to work with Robert Altman, he'll show up in The Player and be part of a joke that's all about, you know, sacrifice and creativity. His greatest bit to me is the part in Ocean's 12, you know, again, a chance to work with Steven Soderbergh, you know, and pull off a meta joke on top of a meta joke. And just show that, hey, once again, I'm funny, you know? I can be really funny. I get the joke of this. I know I've got the timing down of it. I know exactly how to play this. His versatility, I think, gets overlooked way too often because I think he could do a lot of stuff and did.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, down to even being a great late night guest on the David Letterman show.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, exactly. How many times did he show up on Letterman with, you know, an inspired physical bit and then was able to go toe-to-toe and hold his own opposite a sharp comedic mind like Letterman. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't you break down the structure of your book, the sections that you kind of split it into to give folks an idea of how you were ordering this.
Sure. So I focused on 5 different categories. The first one was comedies, and I wanted to start with Blind Date and almost talk a little bit about coming off of Moonlighting and trying to figure out, you know, his way into the movies. I think there's some really interesting examples of people who were doing it at that time. Tom Hanks, obviously coming off of Bosom Buddies and finding his way with movies like Splash and Bachelor Party. It was really interesting. I thought in talking about the comedies, I found a great, you know, anecdote from Kevin Smith. And I want to know what you think about this as well, too. Kevin Smith said, like, the comparable to Bruce Willis at that time coming off of Moonlighting was more Bill Murray than it was anything else. And that, you know, if Bruce had connected on some earlier comedies, maybe he'd have gone down that route, you know, been on that track instead of the action hero one that Die Hard put him on. So I go from comedies to his action films, because obviously you can't ignore action as a genre. And I talk about movies like Red and Red 2, Last Boy Scout, some of his more traditional ones. I get into his collaborations with auteurs. We didn't even mention Robert Zemeckis. You know, he teamed with him for Death Becomes Her. Sin City and Robert Rodriguez. He did Moonrise Kingdom with Wes Anderson. You know, these are directors who I think Bruce went out of his way to work with because he just wanted the opportunity to. I do his dramas, straight dramas that he did, and in that talk about some of the failures that he had with Bonfire of the Vanities, some of the overlooked gems like 16 Blocks, which again, I think he took because of Richard Donner, his chance to work with him. And then the Die Hard franchise gets its own, you know, section because it has to at this point. I mean, it's his seminal franchise. And I talk about the highs and lows of that franchise as well, too, and what he allowed to happen to that because the fifth one is so inexcusable. And, you know, this Die Hard battery commercial, which is the last we ever got to see of McClane, is, you know, beyond sad that that's the send-off of a character that put Bruce Willis on the global map.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets, with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Yeah. No, the idea of him hitting big in some comedies early and then that diverting him off the action action path is an interesting one to consider for sure. And who knows? I mean, this is the kind of secret magic of Die Hard, which is that he was I wouldn't say he was accidentally cast in that. He was not the first choice, certainly. Yeah. And it did come to be his defining role, the kind of thing that people recognized him as.
Sure. But then when you think about that Bill Murray comparison a little bit more, if you think back to Willis in Moonlighting, like if that guy does Stripes and Ghostbusters, you know, which he very clearly could, you mm-hmm. know, he had that comedic sensibility, then all of a sudden, you know, it's Willis doing What About Bob and Quick Change and movies like that, you know, and he isn't the action hero. He doesn't get sent down that career path. So I find some of those diversion, you know, these diverting paths to be really fascinating in an actor's career.
Yeah. Of course, one director who Bruce Willis did not get along with was Kevin Smith. Yeah. We've all heard the stories, most of them from Kevin Smith, about that. But that was one of the I don't know, infrequent, like, disastrous efforts.
Oh, Cop Out is awful. It's a really bad film. And there are really bad films on Bruce's filmography, and not even the latest ones. You know, mm-hmm. there's ones that I don't think the movie he made with Rob Reiner and Michelle Pfeiffer called The Story of Us is really, to me, that's just one screeching argument for 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he'll talk about taking a film like The Jackal, you know, because it allowed him to work with Richard Gere, but it's not a good film, you mm-hmm. know. Mercury Rising, The Siege, you know, there's a bunch of movies that he tried that you're like, I don't really know what you were doing here. And it definitely didn't work out the way that you wanted it to. But, you know, again, I have to give him credit for risking it and taking chances and coming off of Die Hard with a Vengeance and saying, I'm going to go make Nobody's Fool because I'm going to get a chance to share some scenes with Paul Newman. You know, it's not... he's not even listed in the credits for Nobody's Fool, you know, but he has a significant supporting part in it. So, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, the more I went through and learned a lot of these stories, the more I sat down and dug into his filmography, the more that I thought, like, this is a body of work that needs to be celebrated a little bit more than it is, primarily because he's retiring. We're not going to get a chance to see him do much else. And I'm not quite sure that Hollywood frames him the way that he should, because I think he gets... a little bit, you know, maybe because of the Kevin Smith stories recently, he gets thought of as this egotistical, a little bit, you know, hard ass, which he probably was, you know. Mm-hmm. I knew I wasn't going to get a chance to speak to him for the purpose of this book. I knew that the family was going to almost circle the wagons and be protective of him after the diagnosis. And of course they should. Like, that's the way it should be.
Right.
So I wanted to rely on analysis. But I don't doubt that somebody could write a story about Bruce Willis off screen and have some difficult stories to tell. You know, I mean, promoting the Planet Hollywood franchise and the music attempts that he had but also you don't rise to that level of superstardom and not have, you know, some skeletons. I'm sure that he's got some terrible stories, but they're not in my book. I didn't want to go that route. I didn't want to focus on that. I kind of wanted to celebrate what he'd accomplished on screen.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. We do. So, all right, let's ask what your process was here. Did you watch these movies chronological order? Did you just go by release date? Like, all right, I'm going to watch this one, then this one, or break them up by section? What'd you do?
I went by the section. So for a while, I just lived in his comedic realm. And in the comedy realm, well, in each of the realms, then I would go chronologically.
Okay.
And often it meant that, like, let's say around The Whole Nine Yards or something like that, I would then watch a couple of things that he was doing before that and a couple of things he might have done right after to sort of see, like, what was the arc that he was on, sort of thing, or how does this fit? Or especially if it was something kind of unusual, like G.I. Joe, you know, I'd be like, well, what was he doing at this time? What else was going on? You know, how come this decision? And I wanted to, especially when I get into science fiction, the sci-fi realm, there was a time in the 90s when all of these guys were diving into sci-fi. You know, Arnold was doing Total Recall and coming off of T2, and Stallone started doing Demolition Man. And it just felt like the industry as a whole was sort of going after that. And what did Bruce do in that time? That's when he ends up doing Fifth Element. That's when he finds 12 Monkeys. He did Surrogates a little bit later. Like, he always kind of had a foot in science fiction or have an interest in that. But so I would live in the realm of the topic I wanted to talk about and really spend time with the movies, watch them a couple of times, read a lot about what other people were saying about them, form my own opinions about them, read a bit about what Bruce was saying about them. And then I'd shift on to the next section. I'd get into his dramas and I'd try to map about where they fell in his career, where they fell in the industry as a whole, and just try to comment on not just him, but like everything that was going on in Hollywood at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So you did then have to watch all of the direct-to-DVD movies. I use that term advisedly. the Redbox specials, let's call them.
Sure.
That kind of littered the last 5 years or so of his career.
I did. So ultimately I wanted to have this book be, the book is structured very much as a way for people to pick it up and sort of bounce around it. Like, if you want to read it from start to finish, it works that way. If you want to pick it up and flip to the movie that you love the most and start reading about it, you can do it that way as well too. But then at the end of the book, I wanted to truly have an appendix that just really goes through a capsule review of every movie that he's ever done. And so that required sitting down to watch. There's 115 titles. And as you mentioned, there was one that I couldn't find anywhere. It's called Breakfast of Champions. I think it's so bad that they just decided to scrub it off the planet. You cannot find it anywhere. I was going to buy like a DVD copy of it off of eBay and I couldn't find anything. Even there was like a pirated version on YouTube that still only existed in like 7-minute chunks, and I couldn't get the entire movie to play out. But so right around, you know, the time that he does Death Wish with Eli Roth, he starts to go down this slippery slope of these directed DVD movies where he legitimately plays some version of a small town cop at a desk. Who is in support of the younger main hero that is, you know, often Frank Grillo or Chad Michael Murray or someone like this. And so you start to realize that they're all coming from this one production house. They primarily shoot in Georgia. They require Bruce to be on set for 2 days, two to three days maximum. You learn now after the fact, due to the diagnosis and his inability or the difficulty to process communication, we're hearing being fed lines through earpieces. When you pay attention to the way that these films are shot, there's very clearly a body double in most of the scenes that's standing in for him. You can tell that Bruce is filming something by himself, and whoever he's playing off of in a scene is clearly shooting on a different day. And they're really sad. Like, I don't understand necessarily why he did them. They're very tired, very cliched. You know, they're 90 minutes to the – it's the only saving grace of any of these is that every time I sat down to watch one of them, it was like 87 minutes, breach, excellent, yes, let's do it. And I don't quite get why he did them. Like, I don't think he needs the money. You know, maybe there's something going – like, you hear about Nick Cage owes taxes. That's why he's doing a ton of these things. I don't think Bruce needed that, but there's an element of people saying that he just liked being on set. He still liked being involved in the process. You know, he was a fan of the action, but there's nothing in those movies that you can point to be like, oh yeah, I appreciate what Bruce was trying to do in this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate. I've only watched a couple of them and I just stopped. I was like, I can't put myself through this.
No.
I can't watch the guy I remember from, you know, Die Hard and the Fifth Element doing this.
But
this
then you will, it's so random, the people who show up in them. Like, there are three or four that are legitimately entertaining. I don't remember the names of them necessarily, but one of them is essentially Die Hard at a hydraulic plant. And Bruce is playing the Hans Gruber part, which is kind of fun. There's one called Corrective Measures, where Michael Rooker is the warden at a prison for superpowered inmates. I mean, like, some of them are like,
you know,
oh, okay, cool. Thank you for trying this.
Backdoor Unbreakable sequel.
Yeah, exactly. But the majority of them are, and there's one I can't think of, but Christopher Maloney is in it, and he legitimately is having a great time and tries. And I was like, oh, this is great. You know, this, this one's good. But
yeah, no, it's unfortunate. And look, they're, it's easy for us to say, well, why is he doing this? But, you know, if somebody comes up to my house and was like, hey, you want to come sit in front of a camera for 2 days and I'll give you $2 million because I can do that. And I would probably be like, okay, sure. Why not?
Yeah. You know, I know
it's not the end of the world.
It's hard to fault him, I know, but.
And it doesn't take away what is good. So what is on your Mount Rushmore? You have this Mount Rushmore section at the end. What is your Mount Rushmore Bruce Willis movies?
So I believe that two movies have to be there. Die Hard, the first Die Hard, obviously, and Pulp Fiction, I think, have to be there. After that, I think people can make arguments for whatever they want to make. I go back and forth between The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable, his first two movies with M. Night. Unbreakable to me is a better movie. I think Sixth Sense had a much bigger impact, obviously. I mean, that was a cultural, it changed the culture, you know, and it elevated Bruce's career. I think his career was already, I think it did. I think to a certain extent, those two movies did prove that he was a better actor than people were giving him credit for. And he did this sort of quiet, reactive stuff and let Haley Joel Osment, but Haley Joel Osment was giving one of the greatest kid performances we've seen to date. So so my third one would be Sixth Sense or Unbreakable, interchangeable. And then my last one is 12 Monkeys. I think his performance in 12 Monkeys is so great. And I wouldn't have thought that until I went back and revisited it for this movie. I probably would have gone with something a little more populist. But he's the glue that holds that entire story together. You have to be questioning that entire time, is this guy actually from the future or is he imagining it because he's a patient in a mental health facility? And it bothered me watching it how much overacting Pitt does. And then it allowed me to appreciate how stoic and rock solid Bruce was in cementing this confusion, you know, and I felt his confusion and it hit me in a way that I probably didn't grasp the first time through. But when that movie came out, everybody was on Pitt's bandwagon because of Seven and, you know, he was a hot young star. And I get that, obviously. But like, if you had told me, having watched that movie now, that one of these two gets an Oscar nomination and it was, you know, not Bruce, I would have been stunned.
I would not. I recently rewatched it not too long, maybe last year. There was a new at the time Arrow 4K that came out. It looks great.
Everybody, okay. You know.
But it's funny. I watched that movie and I was like, no, I get why Brad Pitt got the Oscar nomination because he's doing the most acting.
He's doing
the most acting in that movie. Bruce Willis is kind of letting it. I'm glad you go to bat for Unbreakable because it is also my favorite Shyamalan and probably my favorite or one of my favorite Bruce Willis performances. I just think I think that whole thing is great. And it exists in this very strange kind of in between Twilight moment right after I think had X-Men come out yet? It was after Blade, but I think either the same summer
had
as,
come out. I think X-Men was 2000 and Unbreakable was 2001, I believe.
Yeah. So it was, but it was right at that time. It was before Spider-Man came out, I think. Anyway,
yeah,
it's
2002.
It's right in this time. It's right in this before time where like comic book movies are starting to be a thing, but not really quite not the cultural phenomenon, cultural behemoth. And then you have this whole movie that is basically a guy who has been warped by comic books saying like, I'm going to create an enemy for myself. And that guy turns out to be Bruce Willis. It's good. Yeah. Anyway, I love that movie. I love that the performance in it is great, and it really is just Shyamalan doing fantastic stuff.
Do you remember the pressure on M. Night to follow up Sixth Sense too? Like all the eyes on his follow up to that movie were like red hot. You know, like what is he going to deliver? How good could it possibly be? And the general reaction was, oh, this isn't nearly as good as Sixth Sense. But now with some distance, it's like, it's a terrific movie. People need to give it the credit that it deserves.
Yeah, no, totally. And this is, I mean, I think that whole early part of Shyamalan's career has gotten, I think, an appropriate, reassessment is the wrong word, because the Unbreakable was relatively well received. Signs was very well received.
Yeah.
The Village was not, and that one has, I think, been a little bit reassessed. But coming off of the enormous success and the surprise of The Sixth Sense, I mean, it's not just that it was a surprise hit. I mean, this film itself was builds to this, you know, shocking revelation that I think kind of threw people off a little bit.
But the relatability of Bruce allows those movies to work. Like, I've been saying this a couple of times, like, try to put Schwarzenegger or Stallone in any of those movies. You know, they just don't work. Those guys just can't do that. They can't make themselves human enough or relatable enough. You know, even Stallone's most relatable character is Rocky. He's a boxer. You know, he's still a character that we're not going to be able to place ourselves in the shoes of. But Bruce always plays that sort of family man, husband kind of guy, and we can kind of relate to where he's coming from.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, that was pretty much everything I wanted to talk about. I always like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything folks should know about, aside from, of course, where can people get your book? Amazon?
Yeah.
Wherever
Amazon,
books are sold?
Bookshop.org, all the different places. It's on the shelves at all different places. It's been fun to sort of go around and see it sitting on the shelves in different places. You know, I really do hope that this book reminds people of a lot of the great movies that he's in. This has been such a rewarding sort of journey recently, because I keep bringing up movies and people are like, oh my God, that's right. Yeah, that one. And, you know, he obviously has his five that everyone sort of circles and knows, like, oh yeah, Bruce Willis. But then you're like, you bring up these other films like, you know, Death Becomes Her or Last Boy Scout, and you're like, oh my God, I haven't seen that in forever. So it's truly, I hope, a companion piece to like a stack of Bruce Willis DVDs and just take the time to go back through his career and remind yourself why he's so great.
Has anybody reached out to you about programming a Bruce Willis retrospective festival type
Not
thing?
Yet. No Not way. Yet, but I'm ready. I'm ready. I would love to.
We got to send the Charlotte area theaters an email. So get Sean over there. He can do a weekly series.
That'd be amazing.
People would enjoy that. I know I would. All right. Well, again, the name of the book is...
It is very simply Bruce Willis, with a big shining picture of him on the front, but it is celebrating the cinematic legacy of an unbreakable Hollywood icon.
There we go. And it is available in bookstores now. Go pick it up. Great Father's Day gift. I know. Yeah, I know. The dads love Bruce Willis. That's a fact. I'm a dad. I love Bruce Willis. I have a dad. He loves Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis, big fan. Big fan. Dads love big Bruce Willis fans. And we have Father's Day coming up this Sunday. So just get out there, pick it up. It's a great gift. So, Sean, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Anytime, Sonny. Talk to you soon.
All right. Once again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm the culture editor at The Bulwark. And I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.